Welcome to another episode of Bitcoin, Fiat and Rock and Roll, the podcast where we explore how blockchain technologies are reshaping money and financial infrastructure. Today's episode is about what happens when stablecoins stop being an idea and become something you actually have to run at scale. My guest today is Max von Wallenberg. Max started his career at Goldman Sachs, spent the years leading up to the financial crisis at Lehman Brothers, later ran regulated digital market infrastructure as CEO of Börse Stuttgart Digital Exchange, and today is building stablecoin infrastructure at scale as part of MoonPay. That mix of capital markets, regulation, and hands-on execution makes him a very grounded voice for this phase of the market. Max, welcome to our podcast.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
Cool. Max, I don't want to dive too deep into your CV to get us started, but I do want to anchor your perspective. You've seen financial infrastructure from inside tier one banks through crisis and later as an operator of regulated digital markets. Tell us a bit about your background and what brought you here.
Yes, sure. So I'm almost 20 years now in financial services, which is pretty crazy to think about it, how time flies. So I started my career at Lehman Brothers, of all places, back in the days. I actually worked at Goldman for a brief time as well, but I worked on the trading floor at Lehman Brothers in the oil and gas trading desk. My manager told me back in the day, you know, Max, oil is sticky stuff. You'll always come back. to it, you know. Now it's kind of Bitcoin, right? Like, that is the new commodity. So I'm pretty excited. That was the start of my career. Kind of saw obviously the demise of Lehman firsthand, but kind of never left kind of trading and financial market infrastructure. I was always interested in it. Went to the US, got my MBA at Harvard Business School, and then thought, what am I going to do with my life? And always had this entrepreneurial spirit in me. And then started a neo broker, like pre-Trade Republic, very focused on social consumer trading experience. And then really crypto came on the scene 2016, 17 onwards, where it started to make, you know, pretty much the bulk of our volumes. Back in the days, it was CFD trading actually in okay. Europe. One of the easier ways to get exposure to crypto. And then really like looked deep into the infrastructure, like what actually crypto stands for beyond trading instrument. And then joined Börse Stuttgart Digital Exchange, led it as a CEO to build one of Europe's first regulated MTFs for crypto trading. Probably most listeners will know Börse Stuttgart, which is, I think, the second largest stock exchange in Germany by now. And then, yeah, went back to my entrepreneurial roots and built a company called Ultimate, which was a wallet, Solana wallet, very focused on trading again, which is kind of my passion and also like deep interest. Built that for a couple of years, which got acquired by Jupiter, which is Solana's largest DEX aggregator, doing, I don't know how many hundreds of billions of volume a year now. And then really went deep into the stablecoin sphere and looked at kind of what's the next phase of crypto, kind of beyond retail trading. And I think we're now sort of the institutional phase of crypto, and stablecoins are kind of this core primitive, how people, you know, very retail audiences will start to engage with crypto without even knowing. And we built a stablecoin infrastructure API called Iron. It actually started originally as a bank. We wanted to build Iron as a bank, but very quickly realized that stablecoin is the much better route to market. Built it, got acquired by MoonPay almost a year ago, and now building all things stablecoin infrastructure for MoonPay.
Impressive, impressive journey. But to follow that up, what's the single lesson from that diverse background that most strongly shapes how you approach stablecoin infrastructure today?
I mean, as they always say, like, think of customer pain points first. If I look at all my things that I built in the past, my career, especially with building companies, it's really listen to the customers and solve a pain point. With a neo broker, it was making it very easy to trade, where back in the days it was very difficult. Obviously, Trade Republic nailed that, and Robinhood. And with Börse Stuttgart, it was all about trust and safety, where you want to pick a trusted partner on the institutional side to trade crypto with. And now with stablecoins, it's very much about building a kind of very reliable experience with, you know, almost the abstracted, like a fully abstracted layer above crypto-friendly banks, to turn it into a beautiful developer experience, to make it easy, simple, straightforward to engage with stablecoins for TradFi institutions, PSPs, fintechs, and everyone.
Okay, you moved away from more the retail side of things, more to the infrastructure. play, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
That's true. Although we're seeing a lot of retail use cases now with stablecoin neobanks popping up and building, which is a lot of emerging markets building almost like global neobanks fully on top of stablecoins. So to now build into API infrastructure for these retail experiences to be simple, easy, and straightforward. Like my retail kind of builder experience really helped to kind of know what's needed on the other side.
Actually, I think that's a good idea to be very retail focused, because that's where you start with UX. If you don't create a good user experience, you are lost, actually. And I think in the institutional play, this is also quite relevant going forward, that most people who experienced a good UX for their own retail usage of financial services, I guess this will be more and more dominant in the institutional play as well. Do you see that similarly?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, for me, it's all about also developer experience, build very clean APIs and treat developers as users, so to speak. And it's actually pretty hard to find like a strong developer experience in stablecoins. Like most of it is very technical and geared towards on-chain teams. But we work with a lot of like PSPs and fintechs that don't really know much about crypto, and they just want like a very easy way and reliable way to interact with on-chain money. And yeah, it's all about thinking about that customer audience.
Maybe one last question to your personal journey. So if you met your 25 self at Goldman or Lehman Brothers, what would surprise him most about where you ended up today?
Yeah, I always thought I'm going to work in like big banks and will stay there and, you know, become an MD in one of the larger institutions. That was something I originally wanted, but you can't fight this entrepreneurial spirit that you have. Like I would have told myself, you know, listen to your guts, do what you're passionate about, and you know, obviously, you know, the money's enticing and the stability of working in a large banking org, but if you're a builder at heart, don't fight it, just go. And I should have even done it earlier.
And then maybe next question. You talk a lot about your trading history and then going for the money rail. What was the moment where you felt, okay, if stable coins are going to work at all, this is the layer where it has to happen, and that's my play. Why did you think that you have to do it? And why was it the right moment in time? Because in this space, many people are too early, including myself. We always think, so now it's getting big. And I think that's the biggest challenge. So where to put the focus that the market is actually picking up? What was that moment to switch to stablecoins?
So the interesting thing about stablecoins is that there's still, I think, 88% of the, or was it 88%, like something like this, like no one knows the exact number, of the use case is for trading related activities, right? So balancing money between exchanges, so market makers moving funds from A to B, you know, without kind of banks involved. And you know, it really emerged, like stablecoins emerged on the scene with like, you know, trillions of volumes, and you know, battle tested infrastructure as a battle tested infrastructure rail due to the trading use case. So you need to understand that first to build a very strong product to, you know, not just adopt stablecoins as a payment guy, but adopt stablecoins for payments as a kind of trading DeFi guy. And that's really strong for us as a team. Our entire team is very DeFi native, and we built with this in mind. We see a lot of competition that comes from the payments world, but the minute they then interact with on-chain money and all sorts of complexities around how it works and how it doesn't, and what is used for, and how the whole market structure is fundamentally different than the classic TradFi world, that gives us a huge advantage. So I saw this, that if you really want to build a new age payment product on top of stablecoins, you need to be a DeFi native person. And that's a pretty big superpower of our team.
Actually, I feel that very much in our consulting every day, that when bankers try to skip the crypto part and just rip out the technology to use DLT for their financial services, which is a good approach, I constantly have to repeat myself that you first need to understand the technology in its native environment. That really helps a lot to have a feeling for what's possible and where you might reach the limits. I think that's very, very much aligned to your experience over the last years and focusing on stablecoins. To make them successful, you need to be crypto native first somehow.
I agree. And also from a distribution angle, right? So yeah. X former Twitter is our, you know, main distribution channel. I mean, LinkedIn is important as well, but you need to really go where the crypto builders are. And we also do stablecoin issuance, which I can talk about a bit later. But stablecoin issuance is something that's very, very interesting for DeFi teams. And if you don't speak their language or understand the product that they're building, it's going to be very hard from a sales perspective to convince them to go with you. So kind of the big important customers we close are also all MoonPay customers, right? Like MoonPay is, you know, all over DeFi. And it really helps us establish like authority as a payments team that really knows this space well. And yeah, that's pretty unique.
So this leads me to a spontaneous question regarding Stripe and Tempo. So they are actually coming from a bit of a different angle to that whole thing. I think they will most obviously have some hired some DeFi native guys in their team too, building their own blockchain. But what is your take on their approach?
Well, I mean, they have 500 million in funding, so I mean, I'm not bullish on new stablecoin payment related chains. But I'm bullish on go-to-market. So when you nail go-to-market and have like very strong early customers, early network partners, these things can work, right? So, and you know, obviously Tempo was doing a lot of things right on the BD side of things. I mean, the technology is good as well. I mean, they built this new TIP 20 standard, like they kind of optimize everything for payments. But, you know, if you look at like the high throughput chains like Solana and others, they do this job extremely well, which we require for payments to work at scale. So that's not something that's broken. That doesn't need fixing. So where these kind of new payment chains are attacking the market is mainly from a BD side. And you need to be very aware that it's not really a technology play. It's a go-to-market play. The good thing is we're fully agnostic in terms of like we can and do work with pretty much every chain out there, and we purposefully said we'll focus on the infrastructure layer above these chains. And for us, it's more about what customers want. If customers say they want support for a certain chain, and if they bring certain volumes, this is something we can easily integrate. But we don't do it the other way around. We don't just integrate chains and then, you know, wait for customers to come.
You come from the demand side of things, obviously.
That's right. Yeah.
And I would expect that many of your clients want to be independent of certain chains, actually. Actually, I think it's a feature to have an abstraction layer between you as a client of yours and a concrete blockchain. Isn't it the case?
That's true. And in the end, it's all about price and liquidity. So if you are in the cross-border money movement space where you would have this typical stablecoin sandwich, like fiat going on a stablecoin, then you send it to a market maker in another country, and then you off-ramp again, let's say in BRL, right? Or in another currency. That's like the typical cross-border payment route where stablecoins are used. And what you care most about with stablecoins in the middle is that they're extremely cheap to get in and out of, right? Like very cheap, like almost zero. Like you don't really want to have a high cost base for your transfer agent in the middle. Now, if you, you know, work on new chains with like not that much liquidity or new stablecoins, it starts to become difficult, right, to make your margins work. So that means where liquidity is super important. And that's why it's very hard for new chains that or new ecosystems to establish themselves without heavy incentives. And that's how it's usually done. Like there are a lot of incentives paid to companies to settle and use new ecosystems.
Yeah, and that's a good start. But then you need to keep the traction over time if you're not able to
pay the
incentives anymore. I think that's the interesting stage you need to get to be a significant player in the market. Cool. Maybe let's get back a bit to the acquisition time. So you built up Iron and then MoonPay acquired you, I think, last March in 2025. And regarding that, what changed for you and your team with this acquisition? I think beforehand, you were a co-founder. You had, I think, a lot of power regarding strategy and direction. How did that develop with being part of MoonPay?
Well, first of all, we know or knew the MoonPay team for a long time. So when we built the wallet Ultimate, we worked with MoonPay for many years. So first of all, like we kind of knew how it is to kind of work together. And that's also how the relationship was built. So it wasn't kind of a fresh start. Then when we looked at kind of this acquisition and working with MoonPay, what was important to us that we're fully aligned in terms of where we're headed and what our vision is and why we're building this. And that was the case, right? As I mentioned before, MoonPay is a very crypto-forward, DeFi-native company that strongly believes in the core ethos of kind of crypto as a new financial market infrastructure. And this is something that we also believe in. And I wouldn't have, you know, sold the company to a TradFi company that doesn't kind of square with that ethos. Because then you run into this problem where you want to do things your way. And you have to kind of fight against a lot of like blockers. Now, of course, it's different to work within like a larger conglomerate. I mean, MoonPay is not as huge, but it's pretty sizable. It's the biggest crypto.
How many employees do they have? Currently?
I think we're like 400, 450 okay. or something. So, and you know, it's the world's largest crypto on ramp. You know, been in the business for I think 6 years now, and you know, I learn every day, right? Like from all the things that have been done in the past. And it, you know, really helps us as well to, as a team, to, you know, avoid some of the mistakes that we might have done, right? Inadvertently, if we were standalone. And I still run Iron and this whole stablecoin unit independently. As okay. in like, you know, we have our own team, like the Iron brand still is a separate brand. Not saying this will always be the case, but for now it makes sense. And we're, from a structural and decision-making point of view, there nothing really changed. Of course, okay, what did change is cool. that we're running under MoonPay's licensing, right? So it's very important for us that we're, you know, fully aligned from a regulatory perspective and from a compliance perspective and integrated into these processes. But that would have also been a complex thing to do if we were standalone, right? Like to run, you know, we have 47 MTLs, New York Bit license, Amica license in the Netherlands, like that stack comes with compliance requirements, which we would also have had independently. But I mean, it wasn't an easy decision, right? Like, you know, I'm a founder at heart, like, you know, building a company is tough to get it to that point. So, and we sold very early, but the reason we did was we, for us, it was a speed advantage of going from basically zero to, you know, all the licenses that are required and like global reach. And we looked at like the competition in the market. And we, for us, it was very important to be as fast as we can to catch up with some of these competitors. And that was the right move.
That's very interesting. I think that's kind of a dream for a founder selling his startup, because the acquiring company usually tries to bind you contractually and keep you motivated. But in many, many cases, at least for me as an outside observer, yeah, it doesn't work that way. Yeah, the founders stick around for 1 or 2 years and yeah, it's not their baby anymore. Sounds very different from your mouth now. That yeah, I think that was how you planned for it, but it seems like it's also the way it played out in the end. Yeah, this looks, sounds very positive.
I mean, we're only 1 year in, as we can say, right? Or like 9 months in, but so far things are good and we're fully aligned. I mean, MoonPay puts a lot of focus on this institutional enterprise segment, right? So MoonPay started originally only as a crypto on-ramp for wallets as a widget. So that's how most people know MoonPay. Now this whole next phase of MoonPay is all about obviously the institutional part, API infrastructure, TradFi companies utilizing stablecoins into, like it's a very different kind of market segment we're going after here. And this is something that is a big push and big focus of the company. And okay. this was important to me. Like it's not treated as a experiment or a bet, but this is a major strategic direction that MoonPay wants to pursue. So that kind of sold me in the end to say, okay, we're really aligned here. Let's go.
So full tailwinds for your mission.
That's right.
Maybe asking a bit about challenges, because on the surface, everything's nice. On that transition phase, what was the biggest challenge for you when integrating into MoonPay?
I mean, migrating like into a big org like this, also from a license perspective, because we onboarded customers to our own license setup before MoonPay acquired us. Now we had to kind of take this and move and migrate this into MoonPay. So we're running under the entire license stack at the same time as building new product and, you know, pushing hard on go-to-market and sales. That was very, I would say, stressful, but just a lot of work. Like the last year was very intense. Deal making, then integrating and go to market all at the same time. So that was a pretty heavy period. And I'm glad it's done. Like I'm glad we're now fully inside of the MoonPay org. And it was worth it, right? Because now we can just benefit from this entire regulatory stack that the company has. But yeah, that was a big challenge. And something that I I kind of anticipated and knew, but obviously for our team as well, it was something that we purposefully had to endure, but now we're good.
Sounds like you need a very strong leadership team. So who's on that journey with you? Who are the most important people at your side these days? What's their roles? How do you distribute that responsibility among them?
I mean, we're very sharp in terms of our pyramid. So it's myself and Omid Aladini, the CTO. So I'm a CEO of Iron. He's the CTO. We built the company together. We even worked together at Börse Stuttgart. So we go back quite a few years. And
okay.
So we make all the decisions here in the company. And
just
we're,
two people?
It's two people in terms of decision making. I believe in very strict and strong hierarchies, few people in control making these decisions. And then we have a very strong, obviously, second in command team around operations and product that are then kind of really putting the things into motion that we cook up with in our heads. And it's very important that you have a trusted circle there of people that actually can deliver and also push back, right? So it's not always we make the right call. Like sometimes people that are more in the trenches have like deep insights that help, and we're very open to that. So
Simple clear responsibilities, but an open ear for everybody. That's
right.
How I would summarize that. Okay, cool. So in preparation of this podcast recording, I obviously stalked your LinkedIn profile a bit. And in one of your recent posts, you mentioned that what we used to require multiple banks, PSPs, and months of integration now takes a single API, that of MoonPay and you guys. That sounds not only like a technical innovation, but like an organizational compression, if you will. What's really compressed here with your approach?
Yes. So maybe to tell the listener a bit more what Iron actually does. So if you're a crypto wallet, a PSP, or a fintech, and you want to use stable coins, you obviously can just, integrate like all sorts of on-chain architecture and infrastructure to support stable coins. But what's really missing is this connectivity to fiat, to your bank account, right? And one of the core flagship products of Iron is a virtual accounts API. So what you do is you spin up a virtual IBAN in your name. So it can be your Stefan Grassmann IBAN, and then you wire or send a SEPA instant transfer into that, and it automatically gets swapped to stablecoins and delivered to the end customer into their wallets. So that's like the core product, our virtual account API. And we do this in Europe, so in Euro, in USD, and in GBP, so in those three currencies. So what's required is to actually open bank accounts or virtual accounts for end customers, meaning we onboard the customer, a retail person or an entity, a business, provide them with a virtual IBAN, a US account number, or a GBP account number. And then they define what output they want, which stablecoin they would want as a receipt to pop out. And then we kind of tie it all together. Now, if you would have to do this yourself as a fintech, you would have to integrate with not just one, but multiple banks per region, because you want redundancy. Some banks support things that others don't. And this all has to then tie together into a single API that your backend as a fintech or as a wallet can speak to. And that's very difficult because all these banks have different compliance standards, regulatory requirements. They have different API infrastructures, different currencies, different systems. And then we have SWIFT support as well, which ties everything together. We also support taking stablecoin and sending it out into 30 global currencies. That's like another product that we offer for cross-border transfers. Think about someone using a wallet, has stablecoin, wants to pay a supplier in Brazil, you can do this with our product. So that, if you would not use an API like Iron, would take you, I don't know how long, like 18 months to stitch it all together. You have to pay minimums with each bank you work with. It's a huge economies of scale volume game as well, right? Because we have, tier one VIP relationships with all of these banks, where it's very economical for us to do this and then kind of package it all into one offering. So that's the core. And, I wrote this post to kind of show how difficult it is to build fiat infrastructure, which is cross FX, cross regional, but make it accessible almost like it's like a single solution. So that's the core of what we built.
Okay. Who is your main client audience? Are these fintechs? Are these wallet providers? Or how is it segmented, your client space?
Three audiences, really. One is wallets, so typical crypto wallets like the Fanta, MetaMask of the world that say, I want to become more like a fintech. Offer me a virtual IBAN deposit address where you wire money in and it then pops out into stable coins. If you look at wallets today, still 90% of wallets' deposit volume comes from centralized exchanges. You know, people go to Coinbase and then wire money there, and then they send money to their non-custodial crypto wallet. So that basically means, you know, the wallets almost, the entry point into a wallet comes via a competitor, which is a centralized exchange. Now, wallets actually don't want this. They want their own fiat infrastructure, their own accounts, their own deposit infra. You know, if you look, go to like a neo broker like Trade Republic, they give you a deposit IBAN, right? And the same will happen to all crypto wallets. So that's audience number one. Audience number two are fintechs, and fintechs that are now building global fintech-like experiences. And a typical one there are like these neobanks that pop up in emerging markets that want to give freelancers US dollar accounts, euro accounts, GBP accounts. And that's a hugely growing market where a lot of people want dollars or want dollar accounts, but don't really have a chance to get them. And Iron enables these fintechs to have instant kind of global rails, right? We onboard customers from 150 countries, open them virtual bank accounts, and clear them into stable coins. So that's number two. And audience number three is PSPs. So payment service providers that are utilizing stable coins for intercompany transfer, right? So like to move money between their entities, but also to pay out and settle their merchants in stablecoin. And that's something that's growing very fast. A lot of PSPs took notice after Stripe acquired Bridge. It's like, what's happening here? Are we missing something? Let's go. And like a lot of these conversations are, you know, PSPs calling us and saying like, how should we use or can we use stablecoins? So it's a bit of an educational component there as well. And once you tell them about the advantages of, you know, real-time cross-border money movement for, you know, a fraction of the cost that you would have with classic providers, they're sold, and it's a pretty easy sell.
Okay. How do you see banks? So now in our client base, Atuco, for example, many banks finally wake up and say, okay, there's a lot going on beyond just trading crypto, but stablecoins is a new kind of money coming along. Many of them going also in the direction of setting up wallet infrastructure. Then they say, okay, they see, okay, they onboarded their wallet infrastructure more for crypto, and now it's a payments thing. So would you also see a role for your services for traditional finance and banks, or is this too competitive that you say actually you offer the IBAN?
Well, I think, I mean, yes, banks will become an audience. They're typically very slow in terms of their adoption. Can be either slow because of processes, but it's also obviously they have, for them, it's very risky to adopt new payment rails or new money rails, right? But it's now actually we cross the chasm with stablecoins into regulated financial payment infrastructure such that now banks are taking notice and thinking about how they want to position. You know, JP Morgan kind of led the charge with JPM coin, which are now deploying onto public permissionless networks. It's happening. We can see these tokenized deposits. It starts with tokenized deposits and then they start to open up. But so far, banks are not our customer base yet. It'll come. I think it'll probably be in the beginning be more, how do we become compatible with stable coins in and out, right? Like, you know, spin up deposit addresses, which then clear into US dollar or into euro or into other currencies. In and out, right? So literally that you're able to log into your bank and you're able to swap into stable coins, pay with stable coins or receive stable coins.
Exactly.
Which with our infrastructure today doesn't require the bank or the customer to actually change anything. They just can't, we would do swap at the margin and then stable coins come in or leave. I think that's sort of the first wave. I think wave two, I don't know how long it will take, maybe 24 months, 36 months, I don't know. Maybe I'm too bullish here, where banks will have to upgrade infrastructure to become more blockchain native. I firmly believe that crypto / blockchain will become the future settlement rail for capital markets and kind of the global money system. and banks will have to adopt or die. I mean, the banks that will adopt to this new standard will be the winners.
When you talk, typical bankers talk about stablecoins. What do they usually underestimate in this little revolution that we see unfold?
Same as they underestimated with fintechs. So the banks really believe that their customer base is extremely sticky and won't really leave, right? But you know, you see competition all over the place. FX already, there's heavy competition from the likes of Wise and, you know, even Revolut back in the days and others, where kind of this high FX, you know, profit center of banks, you know, it starts to be eroded, right? And so that's number one, right? Like, the other one is then, of course, also kind of deposits, right? Like, where banks don't really pay deposit to retail investors. I think in the US, is it 86% or something that I read that of deposits are non-interest bearing, which basically means that retail doesn't get anything and the bank actually keeps the full deposits. So this is pretty crazy. And I think it's one of these things where there wasn't really that strong alternatives in the past, but now with new open money infrastructure that grows very fast, it becomes a pretty big competitive, you know, element that banks have to watch out for. And I think banks underestimate how quick companies are to kind of shift, right? Now, companies are, especially with, you know, startups in the AI space are growing extremely fast. Like, we see massive, massive companies evolving that are very happy to use like kind of new money infrastructure. And I think banks have to watch out that they don't lose the battle for this depositor base to stable coins. And that's why they have to innovate.
At least they are used nowadays also with your services. So there are some banks who interact with stablecoins, maybe even as a reserve bank or to exchange stablecoins into fiat. And I think most of your mission is about that interface. And I agree for now that we shouldn't think about stablecoins without onboarding and offboarding to fiat. They are part of the game, and most market participants, because the endpoints haven't changed too much. Most people don't earn their salary in stablecoins yet. And if you spend crypto, you usually use a Visa crypto card or something like that. So that's very true. But don't you think this might change when players like Stripe and Tether push really hard to also change the endpoints? We know the last mile is always the most complex one. But do you worry at all about that fiat and translating part that you are focusing on might go away soon?
No, actually, I want this to happen. I really want the market to go to on-chain clearing only, such that recipient doesn't have to off-ramp and sender doesn't have to on-ramp. Of course, that means we have to evolve our business model, but our business model is not just fiat orchestration. There's two big ways. Like, one is fiat orchestration, which is like ramping fiat into crypto, and the other way around. And the other one is on-chain orchestration. And what on-chain orchestration is, you know, swapping between stable coins, having a compliant and a regulatory compliant way to send stable coins, spin up wallets, and you know, earn yields, issue custom stable coins. All of this is more on the on-chain orchestration part. And I think that part will grow pretty substantially. We also have a product line called cross-chain deposits. And what that basically is, you can send any stablecoin in and get something else out. Can be your own stablecoin, can be another one. And this is also growing very fast as a product line for us, because more and more companies want to enable stablecoin as a deposit, but there is just hundreds of them, and in the future will be even more. So all of this is something that will, once more people use stablecoins, actually grow massively. Like, this is a segment. So the fiat infrastructure bit, I mean, that's, I would say, pretty safe for many years to come, because it takes time for companies and for retail, for individuals to upgrade. I mean, if you look at Germany, I don't know how many people still use cash, but that's been a process for the last 20 years, and it's it takes time. Yeah.
So looking at this banking layer, do you think it will remain really, really hard to abstract it completely away, no matter how good the infrastructure gets? So which of these banking parts have a right to stay, actually?
That's a good question. I think the one thing where, you know, fintech so far, or crypto stablecoins, has not ventured into is lending. So credit, right? And this is still one of the things that especially companies use their house bank, as we say in German, your house bank, for the most, which is, you know, I need credit lines and I need someone that actually knows my business, right? And is willing to take risk on the books. And this is not something that stablecoins today are solving or have even ventured into, right? So that's one area. And there's a couple of companies that are addressing this or going into it, but it's going to take time to address it. And I think like the fiat orchestration that kind of we work with banks, it's still very splintered and fragmented, right? Everyone has their own systems. The ACH system in the US is hilariously broken when you use it. There's still very high risk with ACH reversals, which we don't even have that much in Europe. I think ZIPA actually is a fantastic system, and I'm very happy using it.
Okay.
I think that complexity, that silo-ness of different money systems across countries and banks will still stay for the foreseeable future. So there's us solving this is still a very big need.
Do you think the credit thing in DeFi, it was always anonymous or pseudonymous, so nobody cared? So if you want to do Bitcoin lending, you just need to own Bitcoin and you can lend against it. But now with the new identities coming closer to digital, like the EID in Switzerland or the EIDAS in Europe, that might change the credit game considerably also for DeFi players who are not afraid of knowing their customer intimately, maybe beyond on-chain. So I think in the past, it was only true what you could prove on-chain, what you own, and then lend against it. Don't you think this might soon change with these electronic IDs available now or in an electronic world?
I think it's mainly about uncollateralized credit that's missing.
Yeah.
So you have
exactly
to understand the company well. And I don't know whether ID solves it. I think it's more understanding the risk of the company you're lending to, right? So with now what's really like solved is collateralized lending, right? And there are a lot of like good companies that you can use, like sure. Lava, for example, to like, you know, borrow against Bitcoin. And that's these are beautiful products, but it doesn't solve the need of a company that needs credit against their future cash flow. And this is something that's very difficult and time consuming. Maybe AI will help here to make these loan decisions faster. But that's not fundamentally something that crypto can really solve, at least not 10x better than what the classic world does today.
Okay. So I think we agree for now, stablecoins are kind of the interface, but the banking is still the engine in the background that we need for the time being. But let's see how fast that might change. Maybe touching a bit on regulation, because you can't talk about stablecoins without the whole regulation thing. But for years, I think regulation was framed as the main blocker here. Listening to you, it sounds more like regulation is now table stakes and operations are really the challenge. Am I right, or how do you see that?
Yes and no.
Okay.
It's a bit of a more nuanced answer. I mean, for example, now in the US you have the Genius Act, which people are like probably aware of, to regulate stablecoins. Now it's being reopened again to cut out yield from it, right? So maybe a bit of an explainer to the audience, like it was allowed or is allowed in the US to earn stablecoin yield as a platform. So for example, Coinbase can earn yield and can then pass it down via rewards. And that's what's typically happening right now in the industry. And that's how a lot of like stablecoin issuers and platforms have evolved. Now, this regulation is being reopened and contested such that now they want to like exclude yield and say like you can't actually pay out yield, not even to the platform. So, you know, unless like regulation actually becomes very dependable and in a way plannable, it's still a problem, right? And MiCA also is not as clean as everyone hoped. Now, you know, it's good that we have the MiCA regulation across Europe, but if you then, once you really dive in and realize that it's still very fragmented, right? You know, for example, you still have Poland today where, you know, there's a battle going on whether, you know, the MiCA applies and it should, but you still have a lot of like Polish RASPs which are operating outside of the MiCA guidelines. So I think it's difficult once you have like splintered geographic, splintered jurisdictions that all have their own interpretation of the law. that makes kind of adhering to guidelines a bit tricky, right? But regulation in general is really important. Clear regulation is really important for stablecoins to win, because large enterprises are not going to use them if they can't really trust that, like, it's a legal instrument that they, in a compliant manner, can use. And I think that we arrived there, and that's why PSPs and TradFi is really on ramping to this new, pun intended, by the way, to this new payment rail. But we still have, like, work to do to make it happen.
I think cash equivalents might be a very important piece that's still a bit missing for corporate treasurers, etc. I think they are still a bit hesitant to really embrace stablecoins fully, because that's not the ultimate clarity doesn't seem to be there yet.
Yeah,
but I think the big players like Siemens and BMW and others in Germany are obviously starting to look into that. And I think that might change the game considerably if the big corporates say, okay, we want to handle cash flows internationally via stablecoins. That's a very new audience, I think, that could give an enormous kick to the whole
development.
Absolutely.
I agree. Yeah.
Okay. We need to speak a bit about issuance. Yeah. Because issuance appears in US stack kind of like a little configuration option. Who actually still needs to own a stablecoin these days? When we look at Europe, now we wake up slowly that it doesn't need only USD stablecoins, but maybe Euro stablecoins, or also speaking for Switzerland. But because I was close to some developments there, I think it would be very nice to have these. Where's the space of new issuers these days? Is there still any, or how do you see that development? Who should issue a stablecoin?
So stablecoins are often treated as currencies once you're talking about them, but they're actually not. They're not really currencies. Like, one, they're transfer agents in the sense that I want to do cross-border transfers and I want to use stablecoins between PIX in Brazil and ZEPA in Europe. So that's like a big first use case, right? Like, and there's hundreds of billions of volume going via that. Now, stablecoin issuance is not, there are some, you know, local non-US dollar stablecoins that are emerging, and it's happening more and more, Euro being one of them. But the issuance that we as MoonPay have built, so we are building, or we actually offer custom issuance such that you can spin up your own stablecoin, fully fiat backed. We do this together with M0 as a partner. And anyone can come to us and say, I want to have my own custom flavored US dollar stablecoin. And what the use case here is that you, let's say you are a platform that has substantial user base, can be a wallet, can be a DeFi app, a chain even, etc. And you have mainly, let's say, USDC from Circle as depositor base, and maybe even as a base that's locked, like total value locked is often something that DeFi protocols put forward. You are de facto paying interest to Circle or handing it over, right? Now, these can be pretty substantial. Like, for example, there was Hyperliquid, or is Hyperliquid, which is a chain and app for perp trading. And they are launching their own stablecoin. The reason is they don't want all this interest. And for them is, I think, $200-300 million a year of interest to go to Circle, but they just want to keep it for themselves, right, as a platform, or potentially pass it on as rewards to end customers. So the big game in stablecoin issuance is to equip apps and DeFi platforms that have TVL and that have users to, you know, earn the rewards of all of these, the TVL and all the stable coins they have in their systems. So it doesn't matter that that's like a US dollar or another currency stable coin. It mainly matters that it's basically a tokenized money market fund that gives you interest, right? And that's the important part here, and the issuance dynamic. And we support this this issuance piece as MoonPay.
Actually, I followed that Hyperliquid drama quite closely, and I found it quite amazing that these players that have a momentum in the market that have so much power that all the usual suspects except Tether and maybe Circle, so everybody applied to create that specific stablecoin for them, giving away all the benefits to the ecosystem and the community of Hyperliquid. So I think there was not so much business case for these players even in there, but you see how fierce that competition is actually. Every time, I think, the stage is set. something interesting new happens. I think if you have the distribution channels, then it's a very, very interesting game, and you can drive back the revenue somehow into your own pocket. So I think it's a very tough game as a stablecoin issuer these days. Don't you agree?
As a big one, yeah. I mean, I think though, if you are Circle and Tether, you still have this huge brand that people use it because it's extremely liquid, right? Like I can take USDC, or basically, let's say I want to send stablecoin to a market maker in Argentina, right? The odds are high if I say, what stablecoins do you accept, that is either going to be USDC or USDT, and those are the two that are just mostly accepted everywhere, which means that the rates I can get for those, like in and out, I don't have to swap them to another stablecoin for that recipient to be able to accept it. And that's the winner for cross-border money transfer. You want to have as few hops as possible. And that's why, you know, I'm bullish that like there will be kind of a handful, maybe less stablecoin issuers, which will be very sizable or are very sizable, to kind of own this cross-border money transfer agent rail. There'll be many more, like hundreds of stablecoin issuers that are powering these platforms that are almost like internal stablecoins that end user probably won't even see. They just see a US dollar balance. But there, it doesn't really matter, you know, that it's accepted widely. It just matters like what yield you get, what the economics is. But kind of the trading ecosystem, to, as I said in the beginning of this podcast, like when you kind of redistribute collateral between crypto exchanges, what matters most to you is that it's the most accepted form of money. And that's where a concentration of stablecoin towards a couple actually makes a lot of sense.
There are some voices in the market that say, okay, branded stablecoins might be a thing for a Starbucks or some of these players. Do you see that also as a use case, and how would that unfold? So something more on the surface and not so much in the backyards of the capital markets?
Yeah, it can happen. I think like the on-chain infrastructure is so good these days that it's fairly, like, we don't live in these money silos of banks. Once the money is on-chain, whether it's on a different chain or on a different stablecoin, swapping in between
just
them
swap.
Works pretty well. Like, let's say Starbucks has their own stablecoin and you can fund it with any other. Like, that's why we built this cross-chain deposit flow, right? You can literally take USDC and turn it into the Starbucks token, right? As long as that works fine, like the user doesn't have any downsides. It's kind of used as with a loyalty token element almost. Like, it's nice that you have the brand tied to it. So I think that this will happen, and we see it as well. Like, I think Walmart already announced they're going to build something like this, and you'll see more and more of these coming out. And but it might wear off over time if they realize that the benefits are not there. But I think the you know, so far there's a pretty strong tailwinds to build this.
Yeah, time is flying. I think we need to transition to the closing question. So maybe one regarding the last 2 years. So what's something you've changed your mind about in the last 2 years when you think about stablecoin or stablecoin plumbing? Anything important coming to mind?
I didn't actually see that it's as much fiat infrastructure as it is. Okay. Obviously, I came from the DeFi world, having built a DeFi wallet before. Now I'm very, very deeply in the fiat world. Like, it's almost building a multi-bank API on top of crypto-friendly banks and abstracting everything away to make it straightforward. I didn't see it, the fiat bit, to be as much or as dominant in terms of the stack as it is.
So you're building correspondent banking on new rails?
Almost, like, yes.
Cool. And the other way around, if we look 2 years into the future, what about today's stablecoin conversation might feel a bit outdated 2 years down the line?
Maybe even that we're referring to them as stablecoins. I think it'll just be referred to as money, okay. In a sense that it'll be very normal that money runs on blockchain rails. And, you know, to be able to send someone like a stablecoin, just might mean, hey, I send you US dollar, and then everything else is abstracted away at the margin. And I think that's a very good development.
Actually, I can very much agree to that. We did this blockchain circle at Tsuka some years ago, and all the successful players didn't talk about blockchain. So yeah. it's quite funny that this is a pattern I keep hearing again and again. Don't talk about tech, just make it work, put it into the background and propose some value to your clients. That usually helps a lot in your journey.
Agree.
So last question, when this episode goes live, what would you hope listeners to take away from it?
A better understanding how stablecoins work, what they are, what they're used for. I wanted to be very clear about the core use cases, because I'm often asked what those are. And if you're not in it every day, you might not see how revolutionary this technology is. So that's the most important thing for me.
Cool. Max, thank you very much. I really enjoyed the talk. See you soon.
Thank you.
The views expressed are solely the personal opinions of the hosts and are provided for informational purposes only. This podcast does not offer financial or investment advice. Always conduct your own research and make well-informed decisions before investing. Please be aware that the hosts and guests may hold cryptocurrencies or digital assets discussed in this episode.